1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And 51551 is a text number, joe@rte.ie. Matthew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You've been listening over the last few days to the stories generated by Magella Moynihan. You were in the Gardaí as well.
I was in the Gardaí Síochána as well, yes.
And what happened?
In 1982, there was a series of events that happened to me after the Charles Sells murder. Charles Sells, I knew. He was a gay man. He worked in your organisation.
Yeah, naughty.
And after his murder, I was directed to go down to Dublin Castle and present myself before a superintendent. I hadn't really got... I hadn't got an idea what it was about, because while I was in the force, I wasn't openly gay, I wasn't on the scene, I didn't do the pubs, I didn't do anything like that. Okay. But I did, as I said, I didn't know Charles Self.
And this was 1982. There was a... The Hirschfield Centre and
yes.
Bartley Dunn's, they were well-known places where people who were gay unfortunately had to confine themselves, so to speak, in the, as they say, the climate of the times. But anyway,
yes.
That's another story, isn't it? But anyway, you knew Charles...
I knew Charles Self. He lived in Monkstown. I lived quite close. And, you know, we had a nodding acquaintance, you know, relationship, if you like. I mean, relationship is too strong a word. But I was directed by my sergeant to go down to Dublin Castle and appear before a superintendent. He gave me a few tips to have my shoes well polished and put on my good tunic and throw him a salute when I went into the office. And when I went into the office, there was I can remember a very icy, stony atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told I was being investigated for conduct which would bring discredit on the force.
Okay.
And I asked, you know, what was it about? And he invited me to make a caution statement and demanded that I allow him to fingerprint me.
Yeah.
Which I did do. From memory, I was asked, did I know Charles Self? And I said I did. And that was as far as it went. I mean, it was quite brief, but it was an intimidating atmosphere for me. I mean, I was 22 years of age, and I was worried about my future in a job that I absolutely loved.
Nice.
I was interviewed in Pear Street Garda Station, where I was photographed and fingerprinted again, and it was much more intimidating. Not in uniform, there was actually a witch hunt against gay men conducted to try and solve that murder, which they never solved. And in June of 1982, two days before I was due to be attested, we were on nights. And on Wednesday night of that week, we were halfway through our week of nights, our tour of nights, a sergeant and an inspector came into the parade room. We used to show a quarter of an hour before 10 o'clock to be given the gen of what would happen during the day, and if there was anybody we needed to look out for or whatever. We were appraised of the situation, and a sergeant and an inspector came into the room and ordered me out of the room. My colleagues were shocked. I was given 10 minutes to strip and get out of the station.
Okay.
And no reason, nothing. I left the station. My sergeant directed me. Well, he advised me, he said, don't leave. Stay where you are. Come in and parade for duty tomorrow night. I'll fight this.
Yeah.
But I hadn't, you know, I was like a rabbit caught in the headlights. I came home, and the following day, or the day after, the local Gardaí came down to remove any further items of Garda property.
And what would they have been, Matthew?
You would have had another uniform. You'd have a winter uniform. You'd have a great coat. You'd have, you know, baton, notebook, torches, things like that.
Yeah.
And they came down. They removed all the items. And I just, my life for the really the following 10 years spiraled downwards.
Right.
I started to get myself together after 5 years, and I wrote to the Garda Commissioner asking to be reinstated, and I got a letter back to say that they didn't, they hadn't, they weren't going to reverse the decision at this stage. And I think I may—I was actually looking for that letter. I may have—I may still have.
And did they give you a reason?
No reason, Joe. No reason whatsoever. 10 minutes. We want your uniform and get out of here. No reason. I've never, ever been given a reason. I then, in around 2014, I wrote again to HR in the Phoenix Park. I eventually got a copy of my personal file. No, sorry. Before 2014, maybe in 2000, 2001, I sought a copy of my personal file, and they wouldn't release it to me. They did invite me to view it under the supervision of a sergeant in the Phoenix Park in Dublin. I said, no, I wouldn't accept that. It was my file. There were my details. It was information on me. I wanted it. And no way. They would not release it. In 2014, I mean, this thing eats me up. I won't. Nearly on a daily basis. And in particular, I'm still in communication with my colleagues I worked with 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I started writing in 2014. I wrote to GSOC to see if they could help me. And eventually I got a redacted personal file. And in that personal file, there is details of my conduct in Templemore when I was training. There are details of the interview conducted at the Garda station when I applied to join the Garda.
All right.
I mean, which would appear to me to be really insignificant, but yet the major thing they say they don't have. I'll give you a line when I applied to join the Garda Síochána.
Yeah.
Applicant is of excellent character, and he has never come under unfavourable notice of the Garda. My inquiries show that he is honest and sober.
Yeah. But there's no mention of why they drummed you out of the force so cruelly.
No, none whatsoever. I eventually got that redacted file in August 2014, and I still wasn't happy. I mean, it was still coming into my head, and, you know, it was there. It was niggling the whole time. So I wrote again to look for a meeting with the Garda Commissioner. And again, that was last year, stonewalled. GSOC said they couldn't do anything for me. Stonewalled with Garda headquarters. So I then copied all the documents to the Minister for Justice, Mr. Flanagan. And I've been stonewalled there as well.
Now, Matthew, when you were being interviewed, and as you say, and it's hard for people who weren't around at the time, 1982, when Charles Self was so brutally, savagely murdered, he was stabbed on numerous occasions, and he was known, he was open about his sexuality, there was an intense scrutiny, and a lot of people at the time thought an awful rough scrutiny of anyone, it seems, who was gay or openly gay in Dublin, especially. Now, when they brought you in for questioning and did your fingerprints and all that carry on, and they said, did you know Charles Self? Did they ask you, as they did Donald, who was on the programme on Monday, did they say to you, are you gay?
No. They didn't ask me about my sexuality. They questioned how I knew Charles Self.
And you think that was a key question that got you, that gave them, no justification, by the way, but gave them whatever reason, that gave them the reason to expel you from the force.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, to not to terminate your livelihood.
Well, you know, for the next certainly 5 years and up to 10 years, I mean, I was rock bottom. I was in the gutter. Yeah. I was in the gutter. And, you know, it's unforgivable that they saw fit. I mean, obviously I'm not going to name names.
Yeah, I don't.
Two men come down, a sergeant and an inspector, whom I knew. And obviously they were acting on orders. But just to 10 minutes to get out of the station, and that was it. Now it belies belief. And, you know, I look on Twitter and I see, you know, the Pride March next Saturday, they're going to have two cars be decked with the Pride flag. I mean, it's only 36 years ago, 35 years ago, I was treated like a pariah.
By the way, do you think the Gardaí should be allowed into the Pride parade this Saturday?
Not
individual Gardaí, they of course should be. But do you think the Gardaí as an organisation, unless they offer apologies to people, but there is one organisation, one gay organisation who are saying, no, do not let the Gardaí as an institution in. Of course let individuals in, absolutely. But do not let the Gardaí use it to promote their current policies because, and I think some of them instances of child self-murder that the Gardaí were very rough at that time on anyone who was gay, suspected of being gay even.
Well, certainly, they have a lot to answer for. There's an awful lot of questions out there that are unanswered. I'm quite sure I'm not the only ex-member who was treated in a similar fashion.
Now, and reminding people, you're 22, Matthew. You're expelled from the job you absolutely love. They got you, it seems, in terms of their own rules. They got you by... You were 6 months working in a Garda station after coming out of Templemore.
I was nearly 18 months.
Oh, correct. So how long did the probationary period, how long did that last?
2 years.
Ah, so they waited until it was right... 2 years, right to the end of that, where they could.
Yep.
And you're adamant they never said to you beforehand, punctuality, give me hygiene, not turning up for parades. None of that was... in fact, your file shows the exact opposite.
It shows the exact opposite.
Okay, so here you are at 22, your profession that you love and trained for, nearly been working in it 2 years, but also you're if you go for a job interview, they would say to you at 22, especially in the Ireland of 82, what have you been working at beforehand? And you say, I was a guard. And they say, well, why aren't you still a guard? And you have to tell them or somehow get across, actually, I was sacked from the guards. And
Absolutely.
People at that time, people would think, he's sacked from the guards, he must be a criminal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I say, for 5 years, I just can't describe. I mean, you know, rock bottom is where I was. Mm.
And could you get work?
I just on Garda Síochána, confidential, report on recruit Garda. Date seen and observations by divisional officer. The 6th of the 2nd, 81. The 16th of the 4th, 81. The 25th of the 9th, 81. The member is making good progress. He has good potential.
Yeah. And could you get work after you left the guards?
No, I couldn't.
And how did you survive?
I was fairly handy with my hands, and when I was able, I was doing bits and pieces.
And Matthew, you said here, I'm a gay man. Did other people know at the time?
No, I never, even now. Within my circle of friends, and I have a lot of friends, they wouldn't have an idea. I just closed ranks, pardon the pun, closed ranks.
Okay. And that's why we changed your name and distorted your voice and changed some of the details so no one would recognise you. But do you still, like I suspect the people that were serving with you 40 years ago are now retired from the guards.
They're now retired. They're all retired.
Yeah.
Some of them are dead, but there's a majority of them still alive. And to a man, they will swear an affidavit, that my return to work was one of the best in the station. That when we paraded at 6:15 in the morning. We were to be out on the beat at 6 o'clock. I was out on the beat. I was doing my work. And I wanted to get on. I wanted to get on in the job. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
And Matthew, when you were rock bottom, because people now understand, 22, been thrown out of guards and trying to get another job, almost impossible. When you were rock bottom, did you seek help?
I did. I went to my GP. Mm-hmm. The alcohol was playing a big part.
Okay.
And I was living at home and there was stress, you know, there was stress from my parents. They were under pressure. They didn't know that I'd been dismissed. And my father has passed on.
Yeah.
My mother is still with us.
Yeah.
And to this day, they think I left the guards of my own accord.
Oh, my God.
The only people I've ever discussed this is with GP, a psychiatrist, and my former colleagues.
Yeah.
I gave up the drink in 1992, and I've never taken a drink since.
Well done.
And, you know, that's more my life. So I tried to piece together get the pieces back together. But I said, I need closure. This is the one thing I need closure on. Why? Now, they can turn around and use the excuse they didn't have to give a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't justify turfing somebody out, in 10 minutes, get off the premises. And
what could they say? Oh, we picked a name out of a hat.
Yeah.
No, there was a reason that they believed was a reason enough. And there's only one obvious conclusion that you could draw from the previous discussion. By the way, Matthew, child self-murder was never, ever solved. But did the Gardaí ever, after they sacked you, did they ever come near you about child self?
No, never.
So you weren't a person of interest?
No.
Just to clear that up?
No, absolutely.
Absolutely,
not.
Yeah.
They got, my name was gotten from somebody or somebody I knew or somewhere or maybe some organisation. I don't know. And, you know, he's a member of the Gardaí Síochána, no.
And do you know why they asked you in the first place about child self? Would someone have seen you going into the Hirschfield Centre? By the way, was the Hirschfield, which was in Temple Bar, like were Bartley Dunn's or whatever, were they, because it was illegal
at
the time.
The Hirschfield Centre at the time in Fonza Street.
Yeah.
At the back of the Central Bank. That was run by David Norris.
That's right. But I'm saying, did the Gardaí have observation on it?
Oh, did they? I mean, it was all cloak and dagger.
Oh, my God.
It was cloak and dagger. And I mean, you know, if I asked one of my colleagues who supported me, rang me last night, and I asked him, had you any inclination as to my sexual orientation when I was working? No, he said, I hadn't. None whatsoever. When you were directed to leave the station in 10 minutes, we just didn't know.
Yeah, of course.
We didn't know what was going on. We couldn't believe it.
But you reckon that the Hirschfield Centre and places where gay men would congregate or socialise were under observation by the Gardaí because homosexual acts were illegal at the time?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And do you know any Gardaí who did that work?
I don't.
Okay, which you're adamant that you believe they were being observed.
It's the only link. I can put together that they linked me. I did visit the Hirschfield Centre. I didn't go to the bars. I wasn't on the scene as such.
Yeah.
Because you know, after Charles Self's murder, I can distinctly remember the following morning. I was in early. I was in at 2 o'clock, and my sergeant said to me, "There was a bit of activity out your way last night."
Mm.
And he was mentioned the Charles Self murder, and I just kind of brushed it off and laughed it off. I didn't laugh it off. That's a terrible thing to say. I mean, I brushed it off. I didn't want to get involved in a conversation about it.
Yeah, I understand.
And from that time, I think that was in April 82, until June, when I was given, I was dismissed, I was looking over my shoulder. And to a degree, I was looking over my shoulder before that because I didn't want to let my mask slip, if you like.
Yeah.
And I felt I was living a lie.
And how are you doing now, Matthew? And as you say, it's.
I'm, 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 I'm in a good place. Good. But, I mean, you know, I subsequently have gone on to run my own business, etc., etc. But when I heard the coverage that you in the last couple of days in your show, it brought it all back to stark reality.
But the way the depth of, and the strength of your feeling, I doubt if it ever went away, did it?
It didn't go away, Joe. It never will go away, because the what ifs are there.
Yeah.
You know, I read this file, and unless it was written by Agatha Christie, you mm-hmm. know, you'd say this fella's going to go to the top.
Yeah.
But.
And I presume a lot of your class, as they say, did rise within the force. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Supers among them, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And I was the class I was in. It was the A class, and I was fairly high up in that as well.
Okay. So, but you're still continuing, and you hope that the focus and the spotlight that Magella has shone on, among other things, on the Garda files, that you'll be able to get access to your Garda file in full.
In full, and a reason.
Yeah. Okay.
And an apology.
Okay.
An apology. I mean, it's the least they can do.
Okay.
It's the least they can do.
Okay.
I mean, the charade of having two cars in the
Pride Parade on Saturday week.
Pride Parade, and you know, it's a charade. It's window dressing.
Someone being sacked out of the force for being gay.
Yeah.
Matthew, thanks indeed, and look after yourself, and glad to hear things in aspects of your life have settled and you're doing okay. Kind regards to you, Matthew, and your extended family. That's Matthew, former Garda. He didn't want to be a former Garda, but he was evicted after nearly 2 years, including the training then at Templemore, after 2 years serving, exemplary record, sacked because he believes obvious, the Garda authorities discovered he was gay. 1857 1585 51551 is the text.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Think to that story. It's from Matthew, 1982. Homosexual acts weren't legalised, believe it or not, in Ireland until what, the 1993. 11 years later, it's hard to believe. One of the activists who campaigned and is still campaigning on various issues, LGBTQI issues, is activist, archivist, and historian Tony Walsh. Tony, good afternoon. Can you remind people, Tony, of the atmosphere in Ireland in 1982 towards gay people by the authorities?
Good afternoon, Joe, and excuse me in advance if the line's a bit wonky. I'm talking to you from Turkey. I want to say I'm devastated and angry listening to Matthew's interview, but not surprised at all. Ireland was not a good country to live in for lesbians and gay men in 1982, and the Gardaí was certainly not a place for either a closeted or openly gay mm-hmm. gay person. I mean, we have to remind ourselves that actually being a gay man was illegal. Men were actually sent to prison. The government last year during Gay Pride Week, LGBT Pride Week, actually and made an apology for men who'd been convicted of consensual sexual offences right throughout that period. It was a grim place mm-hmm. to live in. In 1982, and I have to say, I mean, some of what Matthew was speaking to you about, I just found my jaw on the floor listening to it. But it also confirmed in public all the information we had at the time in the National Gay Federation, based in the Hirschfeld Centre, of which I was a board member. We had both anecdotal and circumstantial evidence from hundreds of gay mm-hmm. men in Dublin and Cork who were taken down under duress to Garda stations, fingerprinted, in many cases fingerprinted and photographed, in places where the police, it sounds like the police bent the law, to a point in accommodating that, and also compelled gay men to open up the file faxes and their journals. I mean, nobody had mobile phones in those days, but their file faxes and their contact books to expand the network of investigation. And what was at the time what beggared belief and really surprised us and also alarmed us, the National Gay Federation and other groups like the Gay Defence League and the Dublin Lesbian Gay Men's Collective, was that the Gardaí focused the investigation on only interviewing gay men.
And this was the murder of Charles Salt, the RT employee.
The murder of Charles.
33 years of age, killed, savagely murdered in January 1982, for Charles's murder no one has ever been convicted. But you're saying at the time, the Gardaí...
Can I just jump in there and say, it shows you the effectiveness of the investigation is actually still open. It's still open. Yeah. So, frankly, all of that work came to nothing.
And but did he? You're saying at the time the Gardaí, how many men did they? Well, we know they spoke to Matthew, but not only did they have, did in one sense the conversation came to nothing in terms of the investigation, obviously because Matthew wasn't involved, but they did bring up Charles Self's name, and the consequence for Matthew was he lost his job because they discovered he knew Charles Self, therefore he might be gay.
Yes, and what was happening was that the Gardaí would bring somebody down to the station. In some cases, they called to gay men's workplaces or family homes and actually unwittingly outed them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, like, this is a period when hundreds of lesbians and gay men are leaving the country in search of more socially liberal environments, where lesbians are being denied custody of their children in court cases, where gay men were routinely jeered at and beaten up on the streets for nothing else than just simply looking gay or appearing to look gay. And Charles F. Murder Investigation, I want to qualify this, Charles F. Murder Investigation was not unique. It would be followed a few months later by the horrific stabbing, mutilation of Declan Flynn in Fairview Park, the notorious Declan Flynn case. But actually, there were several murders in Belfast, Cork and Dublin around the same period. And we could do nothing about it because there's no anti-discrimination legislation in place. And in Matthew's case, of course, the Equal Status Act would not become a thing until 2000. So there was no anti-discrimination legislation. He was branded a criminal. He wouldn't have dared. I'm not surprised that he wouldn't have dared come out. But the police would have had their own methods of actually acquiring information. And I suspect that, although Matthew doesn't think so, I suspect the reason he was pushed out of the Gardaí was simply for being gay. You know, I mean, technically he was a criminal. The Gardaí was no place for a gay man in 1982. And also, the Gardaí as an institution, I mean, it was institutionally homophobic. We may sort of, people may have caveats about the performance of the Gardaí today and their community outreach in some cases. And of course, as you mentioned, the big conversation that's going on about the presence, the participation of the Gardaí in the Dublin Pride Parade next week. But the significant difference between the place we find ourselves in today and where we were 30-odd years ago is that the Gardaí as an institution are no longer homophobic. But I can say quite clearly, with hand on heart, they were back in 1982.
But Tony,
in many ways, they were also indicative of the state at large. They were simply servants of the state, a country that was a very cold place for gay men and lesbians to live in.
But Matthew said there, which is a revelation to me. When you think about it, he said that it was quite clear to him as a guard that places like the Hirschfield Centre, probably Bartley Dunn's, where gay men socialised in 1982, were under Garda surveillance. So, like, people would ask the question today, who would give a barney what goes on in pubs or clubs around Dublin? Why would the Gardaí have it under surveillance?
For the same reason that Gardaí, the special branch, harassed me for putting up gay pride posters in 1980, during Gay Pride Week 1980, I would have been a strapping 19-year-old, and I was harassed by special branch one night on St. Stephen's Green. We were branded criminals. In some cases, the Gardaí may have, or some Gardaí may have actually considered us subversives. I can't answer that. I am dismayed that following on again from what Matthew said, that there's been no acknowledgement of the anguish and suffering that the Gardaí caused him. And more pertinently, from my own point of view as an activist and somebody who knew Charles Seven, who lived through that case, and campaigned against the police harassment and brutality that we saw on the streets at the time, that there's been no public acknowledgement of the Gardaí's questionable role in this case. Okay, there's been no acknowledgement. And I think, I have to say, I'm absolutely in favour of the Gardaí participating in the Dublin Pride Parade. They've already done so, actually. Both the Garda Band, along with the Army Band, participated, the Garda Band in uniform. The G-Force, the Garda LGBT gay group set up by Sergeant Paul Franey, have walked in the parade, albeit not in uniforms, but I think they're entitled to walk today in uniforms because they represent a transformed police force, in the same way that the Army represents the Army, I suppose, what many people would consider the last bastion of unreconstructed masculinity. And they participated with the Chief of Staff, Mark Mellish, and the Army Band last year got an amazing reaction on the streets, and they deserve to march because I think they also signaled a significant phenomenal change that's happened in Irish society the last few years.
Okay, let me bring Michael Ryan. And Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
You were in private work for a private company, a hotel, a major hotel chain in Killarney in the 90s. 1998, what happened?
But it wasn't actually private, Joe, because it was a state-owned organisation.
Okay. Great Southern Hotel.
Run by Aer Lingus.
Semi-state,
it's a much more benign story than Matthew's now, I have to say. In 1998, I came out to my family and friends as being gay. And so I was working my way through family and friends during the year, getting around to everyone, and one day I was at work and I got a bleep or a page down to the manager's office. So I went down and he said to me that he'd had a phone call from head office to let him know that they'd heard that I was gay. And so I was sitting there and I was kind of like, in a way, wondering, well, how do I respond to this? Mm-hmm. So I told him, yes, that is the situation. I am gay. And he said, I'm very disappointed you didn't tell me yourself.
Right.
And I thought, fair enough, but I thought, well, it's none of your business for one. And I was still working my way through family and friends, so I suppose it was my first indication that the information was gone beyond my control, if you know what I mean. And so he said to me, well, look, he said, I don't particularly mind that you're gay, he said, and if I ever hear that you're not getting a promotion because of your sexuality, he says, I will let you know about that. And he says, because at that time, he says, it'll be time for you to get out of this company.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. So he was on your side in that sense.
In a way, he was on my side, yeah, to be fair to him. And I appreciated the fact that I would then later know that if I wasn't getting promoted, that he would let me know about that. You know, I suppose nowadays he'd probably say, by the way, if I hear you're not getting a promotion, I'll help you fight that situation or whatever the case may be. But I think it was just that it was 1998 that you know, it wasn't just the 80s that this kind of stuff was happening. And, you know, I had spent 5 years building up my career to that point.
So he says head office in Dunleary in Dublin, of the Great Southern Hotels, it went on to him to let him know that it had come to their attention that I was gay. Yeah. How did it come to their attention? And what business is it of theirs anyway? But anyway, how did they ever tell...
I never did find out. I didn't particularly mind that, you know, somebody probably had run around the organisation. You know, we only had 7 or 8 hotels, so we all kind of knew each other very well. And somebody had obviously said something to head office. But it was interesting that they felt it was worth a call down to the general manager, you know, just to let him know that they know. I'm not sure what they expect him to do with it or not, but...
Okay, let me say there, Mike. Let me bring in Jerry McArdle, 51551 Joe at RT.ie. Jerry, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Jerry, you remember, and as a lot of gay men do, the horrific murder of that lovely man, Charles Seven, 33 years of age.
Yeah.
Were a lot of gay men brought in for questioning?
No, well, I wasn't brought in. I mean, they did question, as far as I know, everybody in the gay community. I wasn't brought in. Now, two Gardaí called to my house at the time, which I was sharing with another guy. We weren't partners. We were just sharing a house.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to say, you know, and I'm not doubting Matthew's experience. I'm not doubting Tony Walsh, anything he says. But just personally, I have to say that the two guys who called to my house, they were gentlemen, they were courteous, they treated us with the utmost respect. I've never had any problems with Gardaí.
Well, in fairness, Matthew wasn't saying he had difficulty with the interview. He was sacked because they found out he knew charred self, but which wasn't a crime, as you know. But the crime
but Tony, sorry, Joe, Tony, I think, used the word witch hunt. Now, I know, look, there are Gardaí and Gardaí. And obviously, people within the Gardaí.
Well, why did they call to your house?
No idea. They got my name from somewhere.
And what did they ask you, Jerry? Do you remember? What did they ask? Did they ask you about Charles Self?
No. All my movements on the night of the murder.
Okay.
And they asked us for fingerprints. And they said, now look, he said, I'm going to be straightforward with you. You're perfectly within your rights to refuse to give your fingerprints. But then you will be asked later to come to the station and give them. And you can do that, he said, and once we check them, we will destroy them in front of you.
But did they tell you why you were a person of interest?
Oh, the whole gay community were persons of interest. And I said to them at the time, I said to the two guys, I said, look, you're wasting your time, you know, talking to people like me. We didn't do this. But all I want to say is, I mean, these two guys were obviously sent out to do a job.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just in their attitude and in their treatment, it was complete and utter courtesy. I respected the fact that they were given a job to do. They respected the fact that they were in my house, and they treated us both, as I say, with absolute courtesy and respect.
Okay.
And in any dealings I've had with Gardaí, I did have on another occasion. Now, I'm not 25 years ago, were we legal then?
1993.
So in around that time. But I had another incident where I was robbed. I won't go into the details of it. But there was a guy, the liaison officer at the time, appointed to deal with that sort of thing that was happening to gay people.
Yeah.
And I think his name was Finbar Murphy. A nicer man you couldn't meet again. He treated me with the utmost respect.
Okay.
He solved the case. He got my money back for me. So all I wanted to say, Joe, is, you know, that I know people had bad experiences. I'm not doubting it for a second. But I just want to say that it's unfair to tar all Gardaí with the same brush. Yes, there were people, homophobic people, within the Gardaí. Of course there were.
Okay.
But I wasn't aware of it, and I never experienced it. And just on Tony's point about, you know, surveillance of gay venues and that, I mean, you also have to remember, you know, and I know I'm going to make a lot of enemies by saying this, but you have to remember that the gay scene was also synonymous at the time with drugs.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Jerry, good to hear from you again. Jerry, and Jerry went on to have a stellar career here in RTE. That's the same Jerry. Is that the same Jerry? Hey, Jerry, yes, it is. Recognise your voice. No, stellar and well-deserved. Thanks indeed, Jerry. See you soon. Another Jerry on the line who joined the Gardaí. Jerry, you joined the Gardaí in 1979. Your observations, what happened?
Joe, I joined the Guards in 1973.
Oh, 73,
and the latest controversy that has erupted, it doesn't surprise me one bit that Magella was treated the way she was. I'm not one bit surprised. But going back to the, you know, an awful lot of this problem stems from the leadership of the Garda Síochána. And the leadership of the Garda Síochána was infiltrated by the Catholic Church. You know, when you think of it, it's not John Charles McQuaid wasn't long dead, and what he inflicted on this country and the guards, you know, he made Hitler look like a decent man.
Nah, don't ever introduce Hitler into a conversation. I don't want to hear that name. Jerry, you're fine. You're doing fine, Jerry. Just stick to John Charles McQuaid. Seriously, you're doing absolutely fine. Please.
And you know that the local bishop was consulted as to whether this young girl should be retained in the Garda Síochána. The ghost of John Charles was still existing. And you must remember that some of the were promoted to the senior ranks in the Guards were members of dangerous organisations within the Catholic Church, is the best way I could describe it. And they wouldn't have been promoted unless they were in those organisations.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so it doesn't surprise
now. In fairness to Magella and indeed to the construct, there's a nuance in the involvement of Kevin McNamara, the Archbishop of Dublin, in her case. It's unclear to me whether Kevin McNamara, the Archbishop, whether the Garda Commissioner consulted Kevin McNamara, which would be unspeakable, but not as you say, in the post-McQuaid era, not surprising. He either consulted the Archbishop of Dublin about what should happen to Magella, or else the Archbishop of Dublin, through the offices, and as Magella said, the good offices of Cura, the Archbishop of Dublin intervened on Magella's behalf. So we won't automatically assume, we won't get into groupthink and automatically assume that the Catholic Church are baddies in this one. Though the only thing I did find, which Kevin McNamara said in 1983, and it's in, as I mentioned, Jesse Dearmid Farrager's book, Occasions of Sin, and he was Bishop of Kerry at the time. He said he was in Dublin a year later. It is necessary to call things once again by their true names: fornication, adultery, lustful desires, immoral displays in cinemas. So that's a mindset at a particular time. Okay, Jerry, Michael.
Does that surprise you, Joe? Because that was the mentality. And that was the mentality within the Garda Síochána. And like, you know, whoever was commissioner at the time, I forget as to who he was.
Well, it was Larry Wren, wasn't it?
Well, now, I presume Larry has gone back to his maker.
Yeah. Okay.
But he carries a lot. But then again, as to Larry wasn't on his own in making the decisions as to whether that young girl should be kept within the Garda Síochána or not. But nothing has changed. Like, when you look at the Maurice McCabe thing, it's typical of it.
When did you leave the Gardaí, Jerry?
9 years ago, Joe.
Okay.
I joined in 1973. At a time, a dangerous time in this country. But nothing has changed. And the one point I'd make to you at the minute, Joe, is this. We had problems as they were called the Troubles in the 70s and 60s. Things are no different now. The Garda Síochána has abandoned law and order in this country.
Okay, well,
and the reason why the likes, you know, when you take it that Martin Callanan was the commissioner.
Yeah, no, I don't want any current names, Jerry. Thanks indeed. Let me go to Donald. I don't want any. Sorry,
Donald. May I have a word?
Yes, quickly, Donald. Yeah, thank you. You were the, in one sense. Donald, I want to go back to Donald for a sec. Donald, you, in one sense, you're the one who started this thread of the conversation by your very brave contribution, Donald. To hear Matthew say that he now firmly believes, you heard how upset he was. He firmly believes he was sacked from the Gardaí for being gay.
I know. And it's amazing. I'm here listening to it. And little did I know when I was being coaxed onto your programme on Monday and I didn't want to go, I just wanted to support Magella, that so many things would erupt from this, and I'm so sorry for Matthew. It was horrible of him, and for him. And, you know, it struck me there, all the good reports he got, and I got good reports as well. Settled and mature, amenable to discipline, respectful to authority, and should become a first-class member, and got the best recruit passing out, and all those things, and it went on for years. But the last Jerry that spoke about the infiltration of the Catholic Church, it is closely linked, because when we were going to school, I was only five, and we were made kneel down and pray for the virtue of holy purity. By a violent virgin of a teacher that was very, very frustrated. And she took her frustrations out on us.
My God.
And I prayed for the virtue of holy purity all my life, and it all came to a head when I approached my colleague who was being investigated for some disciplinary matter. And I said, I can't hold out any longer. But it's amazing, you know, virtue and the Catholic Church and all, the world is all the same. And, of course, there was an opinion at the time that all gay people wanted to meet other people just for sex, and it was promiscuity and it was risky behaviour and all that. I guarantee you, Joe, it was just like any ordinary relationship. To be close to somebody, sex was only a small part of it.
Yeah.
And I didn't go into the other. Shortly afterwards, there was a few. You asked me the other day about had I anything that happened afterwards that could be linked to it. Yes, there was. I had applied for a transfer to be near my parents who lost our brother. Mm-hmm. And I mean lost. He was never found. He was fishing. And they were alone. He used to look after them. They were alone. And I wanted to be near them. I applied for a transfer. And lo and behold, Joe, they gave me a transfer further away. It was punishment at the time. That was the only thing. Now, it's only since the other day now I'm thinking back.
Yeah.
And then it went on. And then the evening, I'd moved all my belongings to the division I was going to. And on the Sunday evening, I was contacted by a superintendent. He said, your transfer has been deferred. And they left me in suspense for 12 months, Joe.
I didn't
know whether I was staying here or not.
Yeah.
Eventually, I went into the arrangement with the chief in the division, and I travelled to him. And he said, look at you, he says, you're a good lad. Do you really want to go down now? And we want you here. And I said, I want an answer one way or the other. So he got on to B branch, and they said, that file is dead since, with the last 12 months, it was cancelled, and I was only told it was deferred. And my mother died. My father died 4 years later. My mother died 4 years later again, 98. But they wouldn't facilitate me, and I saw other colleagues.
And you reckon it was because of what they said to you? Are you okay?
Definitely.
Have you ever
heard
a woman? Okay, Donald.
Yeah.
Donald, thanks indeed. Tony Walsh, just briefly, Tony, Jerry McArdle's point there that the reason why the Hirschfield Centre and other locations were under surveillance by the Gardaí in the 80s was because of drugs.
Yeah, I don't believe that at all for one moment, Jerry. It comes down to the fact, as I said earlier on, that Joe, that we were regarded as criminals and potential subversives. I'm delighted that Jerry McArdle had a really good experience with the Gardaí in his case, and I've had really good dealings from time to time, and I've had really bad dealings with the Gardaí. There are good eggs and bad eggs in every institution, but both now and then. But there's no way we can sugarcoat what went on, the institutional homophobia. We can't sugarcoat what went on in the Charles Murray investigation.
Okay.
And I'd also like to ask a pertinent question. Whatever have the Gardaí done with the dossier of information, the files of interviews
that they have? Good
that
point.
They created
that
at the time?
It must be massive. Okay, Donald, thanks. Tony, thanks indeed. Donald, Jerry McArdle, and our other colleague, Jerry, as well. 51551.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Joe at rt.ie and 51551 is our text number. The year is 1945. Trevor Martin, good afternoon in Limerick. How are you, Trevor?
I'm well, Joe, thank you. How are you?
Tell us this remarkable story from 1945. As the emergency ends in Ireland, the world is practically at peace, though the world is ravaged. And your father, who worked in a bank...
That's
upstanding,
correct.
Did well, punctual. His daily work was regarded as satisfactory. What happened, Trevor?
Well, basically, my dad was single till he was 36.
Okay.
And he had met my mum a couple of years earlier.
Right.
And my mum at the time was about 18.
Okay.
And they decided that the relationship was going further and further, and eventually they got engaged.
Oh, yeah.
And one day he was in the bank, and his manager called him into the office and said, Mr. Martin, you cannot marry that girl.
Okay.
And my dad was, of course, dumbfounded.
Yes.
And the manager went on to explain, you've got to think of the bank's pension.
Yeah.
You know, very, very authoritarian. And... your wife will obviously live longer than you will, and she will get your pension for years after you're gone.
And she could bring down the bank.
I'm sorry?
She could bring down the bank.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah. She caused the whole problem of
the crash.
Bank having to be rescued.
Yes, she reached pension age in 2008. In September 2008, your mother, I hope she's still alive, is she?
No, not okay. Well, since 2006, but
okay.
She tells a fabulous joke.
Oh, my God.
She says, you know something she said to me one day? She says, Trevor, I got 25 years.
out of them. So they wanted your dad to drop your mum, who he was intending to marry.
Yes.
because there was an age gap of what?
15 years.
And that means, they meant actuarially, the chances of your mother living longer than your father were high.
Quite correct.
And therefore she would be claiming his pension.
Quite correct. Yeah, actually,
and did they nominate an older woman for him to marry, like an old age pensioner? That wouldn't be important on the bank.
No, unfortunately. He had to go to a bank inspector about it.
Wow.
And he did, fair play to him, and he fought his case, and the inspector told him, well, the manager has no right to stop you marrying that girl.
And who used the phrase, over my dead body?
That was my dad.
Ah, what a phrase.
He said, you know, when I was growing up, and I said, yeah, I'm going to go join the bank, Dad. And he said, over my dead body.
But if he had said to them, when they called him in and said, you can't marry that woman that's 15 years younger than you, and we're going to stop you marrying, he should have replied, over my dead body. And they would say, that's exactly what we're worried about, Trevor, that you're going to grow.
Exactly, Joe.
You'll bring us down. The Royal Ulster, whatever it was called, Leinster, all the different names around. And okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man, Trevor, you couldn't make it up.
No, you couldn't. But in those days, I mean, my dad even told me himself, if the knot in his tie wasn't correct, his manager would actually say, Mr. Martin, go and adjust your tie.
If he didn't have a Windsor knot.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah, okay, those were the days.
Draconian would be the word in the bank.
Okay. You can laugh at that, but wait for them. Well done to your dad. Your mother has passed. Has your father passed? Has Trevor passed as well? Has your father passed, Trevor?
Oh, he is indeed. Dad went in 81.
Okay. God rest him. Okay. Thanks, Trevor.
He never got to really enjoy his retirement.
That's a pity. Okay.
But at that stage, of course, they had no retirement plans for people. They went in on the Friday, and he came home, say it straight out, half pissed, with a silver salver, and he said to my mother, where do I go on Monday?
Good God.
I'll never forget it.
Where
will I go on Monday?
Yeah, that's poignant. Okay, Trevor, thanks indeed, Trevor.
Not at all, Joe. Okay, thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
And there was lighthearted elements there to Trevor's story, but Geraldine's story is not lighthearted. Geraldine, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What happened in your case, Geraldine?
Similar story to Magella Moynihan. In the 80s, I was single. I got pregnant. I was in my mid to late 20s, and I was working, a well-established worker in a pretty male-dominated industry up in the, towards the north of Ireland. And I went to Cura for support in my pregnancy and to work things out. I went the same route as absolute same route as Magella in that I went to Galway and I was placed in what they called a host house. You'd stay with a family towards the end of the pregnancy, and I gave birth by cesarean section to a beautiful baby boy. Cura introduced me to an adoption agency representative from the west of Ireland, and the words that Michele used were exactly the same as the words that were said to me, in that we know of a good family that can give your baby something you can't give him, you know. So it was very manipulative, you know. And my mum knew my pregnancy. She was a widow woman. She'd put me through university. We were a loving, caring family, and she went the journey with me, used me with counsellors and that. And I felt they worked on her as well. She wasn't in great health, and she passed away 3 years after that. It's also important to say that I had a very small family. I didn't have, sisters, for instance. You know, I hadn't married family, so I didn't know what it would entail to rear a child. Having said, I'm quite resourceful, and I know now that I could have reared a child myself.
Of course you could have.
So now, roll on the years, and I did meet my beautiful son, whose birthday it is actually today, and I'm thinking of him, in 2012, but the relationship wasn't encouraged. Even since 2012, things have moved on a bit better. But it's important to say I got a phone call from the exact Cura representative that had counselled me in Galway in 2012 to say I should not be uniting with my son, you know. So I'm very sceptical in that regard as to the goodwill, you know. There was no goodwill for the single mom, you know. And I, what we are are mothers, natural mothers.
Yeah.
And heartbreaking stuff, you know.
And like that was 1986, Geraldine.
It was, yes, yeah. It was, yeah. And it took me 12 months to sign the final documents, yeah. You know, because I didn't want to.
Yeah.
But, like, the human side wasn't taken into account at all, you know. And I went back to work, by the way, a week after having a C-section. Went right back to full-time work. You know, that was even dangerous. And I was travelling. Yeah. He was placed in the west of Ireland, and I was up in the north, and I was driving from one end of the country to the other to see him.
Yeah.
Almost inhuman, if you like, you know, the situation. But the important thing was, I think, you know, to encourage us to give our kids over, you know.
Yeah, which was the exact same point that Magella was making.
Absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't believe when I was listening to a documentary on Saturday.
Yeah.
The pressure. Like, when I went for a checkup, I was given a wedding ring to wear on my finger. Now, that had psychological effect on me in that, God, I'm not right for this.
Yeah.
You know, like... I should have a wedding ring, you know. I subsequently went on to marry and a beautiful family.
Yeah, great.
You know, and I know, you know, I would have been quite capable. Also, I did say I've met him,
yeah.
And we're so alike. Again, Magella, son said that about
when David
her son,
walked
you
into
know?
The room. Yeah, he was the spit of her, as she said.
Yes. What we've missed out on.
Yeah.
And now, going forward, I don't believe in looking back. Well, the pain has to be acknowledged. Going forward, there should be not an ounce of a debate about adoption.
Absolutely.
Without the birth mothers being involved.
Absolutely.
You know,
it's
like there's an adoption bill going through the door at the moment. We need to be invited on to panels to discuss all the issues, you know. And I believe, like, I filled in a forum and I have it here in front of me. How would you feel about meeting, how would you feel if in years to come your child wished to contact you? And I've written under, was very happy, thrilled.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, where are those records? To be fair, I got my records from the adoption agency that I dealt with that closed down last year. So they're a revelation. I have a letter here written January after the little fella was written by me, January after he was born, like he was born in June, and I wrote to the council, you know, the person in the adoption agency I was dealing with, and I said, I'm dying to know how John is keeping.
Yeah.
That's the name I gave him.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe you could let me know, is he in good health? How has he grown teeth? Is he getting taller?
Absolutely.
A natural mother
yes.
would want to know, you know. So, but there was no, we weren't counted as mothers, you know, at all. And that's the sadness and the dreadfulness of it. Even there's a story in the name of CURA, it's CURA Crisis Pregnancy Agency.
Mm-hmm.
It should have been CURA Pregnancy Support Agency, you know. And then maybe we would have been going somewhere in being decent to the mothers that weren't married, that hadn't a wedding ring, you know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that's my story.
And Geraldine, I'm looking, people are thinking of you 33 years ago today. You were in the hospital.
Yes.
And people, including myself, want to hold your hand and say, I hope things work out. But did you know at that stage that that child, which you were about, I don't know what time the baby was born at.
Born at 12, just noon.
So he's 3 hours, just coming up to 3 hours old on this day, 33 years ago. Did you know they were going to push and shove and take him off you?
Well, I had it discussed, you know, I'd only met the adoption agency rep twice before that, and it was discussed. You know, but very quickly after he was born, I'd say about a day or two. Bear in mind, I had a C-section anesthetic and all the rest.
Yes.
There was a file put in front of me to sign for him to be fostered.
Yeah.
You see, and you're brought into this bubble, and then as the weeks went on, and he was placed with the parents he was.
Yeah.
Going to be adopted by, I began to feel guilty that if I took him back off with them, they'd go through the same pain that I was feeling, and like I'm an honourable person, you know. And then you see, it just kept, the message was, they can give what you can't. And there was a lot of emphasis put on how he was bonding with Daddy, you know. You see, it was very definitely skewed, you know, towards parents,
and,
you know.
And I remind people, that was only 33 years ago.
Correct.
In this country.
Yes.
Okay.
But moving on, even, for it to be said to me in 2012, not good to be meeting with my son, you know. And we're so alike, you know.
Yeah,
enjoy his company, you know. I haven't seen him with a while because, you know, I don't know what forces are there. But grandchildren, I don't want to miss out. I could start from scratch a relationship with grandchildren. And in many cases, there are three or four grannies now with divorce and, family events wouldn't be awkward.
Geraldine, it's every day is an important day for you. Every day, I'm sure you think about your boy who you call John. Today is a very special day for you. It's his birthday. It's the day you gave birth to him 33 years ago. I hope you can, in the bosom of your family, which you, and I include John in that, I hope in the bosom of your family, you can sit down later on and have a little celebration of what life you brought into the world and the dignity which you've just shown there, talking about it so beautifully, and the other children you have as well. Kind regards, Geraldine, and thank you so much for that incredible contribution. You were a good person, which sounds patronising coming from me, but anyway, Geraldine, thanks again and enjoy the rest of the day. Back tomorrow at 1:45. Angus McInerney producing, Catherine Thomas is next.